You know, one of the things about preaching is that I often forget. I actually use a set of notes, like a behind the curtains look. I use a set of notes mainly because it makes me feel better. Because I already know the text. But it makes me feel better to hold something. And what I'll use this for is for the reading itself. So if I can get to the next slide, we're actually not going to have a special reading of the text beforehand. I'm going to go through the text with you, and we'll read it together. I've named today's sermon, The Agony of Job. So this is Job. This is probably my favorite picture of Job, painted by Jean Bonnat. And it embodies, when I think of Job, this is what I think of. Right. Okay, next picture, please. But here's the thing I want to teach you first about the book of Job. We'll be preaching it in three sections, three sermons, this week, next week, and the week following. The book of Job will be divided into some logical understandings. The setting of the beginning, the dialogue with his friends, and finally, a conversation with God at the very end. So that's actually how the book of Job generally is shaped. The setting, the dialogue with friends, and the dialogue with God himself. And it is the quintessential book about suffering. But I want to share something else with you as people who study the scriptures. Job is a story. Like once upon a time. Job is a story because we use stories to convey a truth that will do an end run against people's biases. It's the reason why Jesus told parables. It's the reason why Jesus told parables. Now, while I'm here, I'm going to ask you a simple question. What is one of your favorite stories? Just, you know, call it out. It could be a movie. It could be a book. It could be a short story. It could be a fairy tale. What is one of your favorite stories? Anyone?
Les Miserables.
Victor Hugo. Fantastic book. Great musical. Has anyone seen Les Miserables? Or Les Mis, as it's often called on Broadway? Yes? If you have not seen Les Mis, you've got to watch Les Mis. It is a fantastic story. There's suffering. There's redemption. It is, you know, there's heartbreak. That's what makes a good story. It's very gripping. And here's the thing, for those of you who know Les Mis, if you watch the movie, the musical, read the book's quite long, it actually changes you without you knowing it. That is the power of story. You see, we don't really know if Job is a real person. It is actually considered the book that is set beyond, you know, creation, Noah, the flood. It's actually a story that comes before the time of Abraham. It's set in a time before the time of Abraham. So after the Tower of Babel, you get the spreading out of the nations. This is where the story of Job is set. Any other stories that are favorites? Les Mis is one. You must have a favorite movie or story. Come on. Or if not your favorite, you may have a whole bunch of ones. Just name one that really... Lord of the Rings, epic Tolkien. Who here loves the Lord of the Rings too? Besides myself and Diana, who has an annual viewing, I believe, of all, you know, three extended versions. It's like 12 hours or so of watching movies. But it's a fantastic book, which has been made into a really good movie, too. And it's fantastic. Although set in a fantasy world that you know is not real, right? although some people don't act that way. Still dress up as dwarves and talk like them. And elves and orcs. But that whole story also changes the person who reads it. Because it talks about so many life experiences. Now, we're not elves that we know of, or, you know, people of Numenor or whatever, but we learn something about adversity, about courage, about honor, about dishonor. All of these themes of the human life are there. But when it comes to us in story, it's not like, hey, that doesn't make sense. We've already said we believe that there may be orcs and elves and stuff. And so you, with that suspension of belief, we actually are able to do an end run and allow the true story to take place. Any other stories? Lord of the Rings is big.
Narnia.
C.S. Lewis. Another fantastic book series, all seven of them, and then some. Narnia is a great series. A lot of children, and C.S. Lewis wrote it in a manner in which people could also understand the Christian faith. The talking lion, you know, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, flying horses, you know, it's talking animals, everyone's favorite. So, they got some movies on it. They're pretty entertaining as well. But again, stories. Anyone else? Harry Potter. Who said Perry? Is it you? Harry Potter. Fantastic series of books as well. I think they have seven, right? In the original. And then now they're adding some more. They got a Broadway play. They got, you know, it's like, they got a new book that's coming out, Harry Potter. And it is about, it's a coming of age story and then some. Fantastic story. Anyone else? Yes. Ender's Game, Orson Scott, also made into a movie recently, an outer space science fiction deal. So again, it's not like you're saying, this happened. It's supposed to be set in the future. And that changes you. So all of these books, if you were to read it, when you hear stories, they somehow, even if you don't know it, they change you. They change your attitudes. Their heroes, their villains, that all the people in between, when you hear a story, it challenges us and pushes us a little bit further in the ways we think about stuff. This is actually why Jesus told parables. No one was thinking, oh yeah, there was a, you know, rich man and then there was a poor man at the door. But wait a minute, they've seen this before on the street. This happened. And Jesus keeps telling stories. Not because these people are absolute existing people with driver's licenses and birth certificates, but because we recognize the types of people. And what happens with the parable is that it does an end run around a lot of our thinking, and then, and this is how parables work, they kind of slap you in the face to wake you up a little bit. And go, well, wait a minute. That's a surprise ending. And Jesus consistently, if you ever had a chance to study the parables in the Gospels, Jesus consistently, all his parables are a bit jarring. There's something to all of his stories in which it pushes what you believe a little bit further off kilter, but closer to the mind of God. Now, why are we talking about this once upon a time and the power of the parable and storytelling? It is because the book of Job is not necessarily about a real person. It is, as movies say, based on a possible real story. There could have been a man named Job. There could have been, there were actually countries such as Uz, where he's going to come from. Don't ask me where Uz is, because archaeologists are still trying to figure that out. They think it's actually south of where Israel is now, and it's sort of a more desert region. But they're not exactly sure, because this is very ancient material. The setting is quite old. So whether Job really existed or not is one thing. But this everything else, remember, it's actually telling you a story to enthrall you so that it might disturb you, so that you might be changed. So understand, Job is a work of literature. And that's what literature is. It is the telling of a story that moves you inside. A little bit further, in particular, in its purposes towards God. And there is probably no more complex book than Job when it comes to literature in the Bible. Some have actually even commented in the Old Testament, there is no story that surpasses Job in its artistry. Now, as people who approach the book of Job, it's quite long and it's arduous. There's people talking, I don't understand what's going on. And so we sort of just gloss it over. Yeah, it's about suffering, right? Yeah, and then God's good. Right? In the end, it's super great. It's sort of like you go to Lord of the Rings and saying, yeah, it's about elves and dwarves and stuff like this, and it's great. That's not what it's about. It's like Harry Potter. Yeah, it's about wizard kids. Good. That's it. But unless you read it and understand the stories and the characters, you have no appreciation for it. You just toss, you know, you just pass it by, say, forget it. You know, it's, yeah, it's about this, I understand. But until you enter into the story, you'll never get it. So I'm hoping that, and this is really doing short shrift to the book of Job, this great piece of literature, in 3 weeks is really selling it short. But my hope is that I'll give you enough so you'd want to read it for yourself. And as you'll notice, we read in multiple versions. We read different versions, mainly because we are given the gift of multiple translations of a text. Often I'll read it from NIV because it is sort of a very middle ground sort of text. If you're really willing to study the text, if you don't know Greek or Hebrew, I would recommend things like the NRSV or the NASB. One of those two versions of the Bible, always helpful. And if you just want to read it for, you know, to get the flow of things, the CEV, Contemporary English Version, or the NLT, New Living Translation, are all great to read too. So because depending on what you want to read it for, whether it's for study or for flow, the English language is fantastic in terms of translations of the Bible. So today I'm just going to go middle ground with NIV, and there's a reason why sometimes we will preach and we will read it in NRSV, NASB, in different versions as well. But here, let's begin. Let's begin this story and this journey with Job. So let me start with who Job is. So can you give me a picture of Job there? This is usually what we think of when we think of Job, right? Kind of like the similar to the first one, the naked guy who's really old and he's like really unhappy. And he's suffering. He's just like real lethargic. He's like, oh, I'm feeling very good, right? Or the other one where he's really like not happy. This is what Job really looks like at the beginning of this story. That's Job. Believe you me, this is Job. Read with me. Look at this. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. So a pretty far cry from that last picture. Show us the last picture again. That's not Job in the beginning. This is Job in the beginning. He's right, you can see his jet in the back, and he's actually a decent guy. Amongst all the people, after the Tower of Babel and all that, he is still a person who respects God. He's a person who worships God, the Creator. Somehow through his lineage, through Noah and the whole lines that if you were to read the Genesis. But he is also extremely wealthy. If you look at this text, there's a reason why they've set it up the way they have. They tell you where he lived, it tells you how many children he has, and it begins to list his assets. That he had all these sheep, these camels, like 3,000 camels. I mean, that's a lot of camel. I don't even know what to do with them. 500, can you imagine all the people you need to herd these things? I don't know, I've never seen a camel in real life except at the zoo. I only see one, maybe two, 3 or 4 at best, but 3,000. And I've seen, horses and sheep, but I don't see them in these numbers ever. Right? Even watching Babe, it's not like they have that many sheep. But here we are, have the 7,000 sheep. How many ranches are you thinking that is? So what you're looking at is a man who is well off. And that's an understatement. And the Bible wants you to know this. This is Job. Can you get the next slide? Let's go on reading. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays. He grew a beard for this one. And they would invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. So his kids would party, but he also wanted them to have some sort of faith, that they weren't just going to go do nutso stuff. A lot like different parents, like your parents, don't want you to grow up, you know, being just a crazy person, just does whatever they want. Some of us might have been there, but maybe if you're a parent, you wouldn't want this for your children either. You want them to grow up decent people. But in particular, Job was very spiritual as well. That when they had their parties, and he knew that they were probably massive to-dos, because his sons would hold these parties, he had 10 children, and they'd all gather up, and I'm sure all their friends, all their, you know, families, you know, children, the whole bit, this massive, the massive party at this, probably one of the palatial mansions. And he would, in the morning after, pray for each and every single one of them. And he would make sure that they were purified. He would make sure that, look, what did you do? He'd be checking in. He'd go, right, we're all in straight and narrow. You know, that's what he's checking in on them. So he really had a deep sense of wanting legacy, that his children would worship God, that they, you know, were a family that, you know, pursued God's heart. And if you saw some of our child dedications, that's kind of like a similar thing. So I hope you have a better perspective of who Job was and who he'll become again. Oh, I hope I didn't spoil it for anyone. He gets not only back to this, it's like 10 times this. But this is where he began. This is a story about a very wealthy, very godly, very caring person. And then we really will see what's going to happen. And here's the setup. If you read the text with me, moving from chapter 1, verse 6 of Job. One day the angels came to present themselves before God, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Or, "Where have you come from?" There's a difference in how you read that. Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright. A man who fears God and shuns evil. Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied, "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then. Everything he has is in your power. But on the man himself do not lay a finger." Well, this is the setting. And remember, I told you this is a parable. This is a story. Do you believe in elves and dwarves? No. But do you believe in their character? Yes. Well, another interesting aspect of note is when you read the word Satan, we always think of the embodiment of the devil. And that's well maybe what he is. But if you read the Hebrew, it's ha-satan, which means, and the word Satan actually means this, it means adversary, the prosecutor. In some cases, we talk about, I don't know if you heard the term, the interlocutor, the one who tests you. The question here is that who is he adversarial towards? And there's a few schools of thought. One of them is that he's obviously adversarial towards God, testing him, where God says, hey, look at Job. He's a good guy. And so he says, no, he's not. Or is he the adversary of humanity? Is Satan a real person, a figure? The answer is yes, because we're taught that in Scripture. And this is one of his embodiments. But in this case, he serves a purpose in our story. There are spiritual aspects of evil and spirits. But in this case, the Satan, the adversary, is his name. And he is an adversary both to God and an adversary to humanity. In particular, he's here to spoil the party. Not just Job's party, but God's thoughts, and he challenges God himself. So let's have the next photo here. This is what you're really looking at. This is, if you imagine it, this is the Super Bowl of the heavens. What is the challenge? On one side you have God and Job. God saying, Job is the man, he worships me, he's a good dude. And on this side, it's Satan's argument. No, he's not. Look, he's rich. Of course he's going to love you. You blessed him so much. You protected him so much. Didn't you read the passage before, right? He's got like 7,000 sheep. You've taken care of him. So, I'll bet his faith is just for show. You hurt him. You give him some suffering. Something that's like a thorn in his side. And he will curse you to your face. Let's make a bet, Lord God Almighty. That's Satan's position. And so what the story really is, when you set it up, it's this. This is the world that Job does not see. But you, as the story reader, get to see it. That there's something else going on. A deeper question. And there are some other questions as well, like arise. Like, why does God accept this? Is it because God is frivolous and says, okay, yeah, you can take Job's stuff. You can hurt Job. Remember, this is a parable. And so when you hear that, you're supposed to go, yeah, what's up, God? What's up, God? Why did you take this bet with Satan? Isn't that kind of dumb? Don't you care about Job and what happens to him? What's wrong with you? Now, you might not say this out loud in the church. You might not say this out loud in the temple. Because, you know, there'll be other people who go, hey, wait a minute, you don't question that. But this is what the text is actually asking you to do. What is going on here? Why is God interacting with Satan? Remember, this is not literal. This is a parable. But what it's beginning to set up is something already, a foreshadowing. How much do you question God? What is the foundation of your faith? Do you worship God because everything goes well? Do you worship God because you want everything to go well? Is this the reason why you have faith? Because if you follow Jesus, he will make you healthy, wealthy, just like Job. Is that why you follow Him? This is where the story begins. And this is where it begins to push. Whether you know it or not. And sometimes we don't ask questions of the stories. But the lingering question is in the back of our head. Why did God let this happen? But it really reflects back. It's like, why do I? Why is this God worthy of worship? That's the question. It is a Super Bowl for everyone's soul. This is what Job is about. This is the underlying reality. So let's move into the first test. Now, God has told Satan, or the adversary, the tester, the mean-spirited one, that he can have control over all that he has, but he cannot lay a finger on Job. So, let's see what happens. Round one. Next photo, please. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One day, when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, it's a party day, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." In one fell swoop, everything that the empire of Job is based on, all his finances, are swept up. Either by raiders or by natural disaster. Now, the raiders, you can understand. That's just humanity at its worst. Sin. But natural disasters, too. So you can't go, well, yeah, all suffering is based on the sins of others. Of people. Here you also are given the fire from heaven itself. I don't know if it was lightning or it was a forest fire or whatever it was, but it's a natural, seemingly natural disaster, but realize that everything natural back in that day was understood as coming from heaven. The inexplicable, that God let this happen, of the natural order, or disorder, however you like to see it. But in short, round one, Job lost his entire wealth. All the sheep, 7,000. All the camels, all the donkeys. In one go. And it just came like dominoes. You notice how the last guy, the first guy, is not even finished speaking. When the second guy runs in and goes, "Ah, there's fire from heaven." And he's not finished speaking. And the third guy comes and says, "And then these raiders came." It's a real blow to Job. Round one. Everything that we saw in that first picture about who he was, all his wealth, burned to the ground. Here's a question. Have you ever been in financial straits? Have you been ripped off? Have you been conned? Have you made a bad investment? Have you been in debt? Whether through a decision of your own or nothing at all. Through financial markets. Through a failure in business, bankruptcy. In which even you've tried your best, done your due diligence, and it doesn't work out. It could be something that you lent to someone and it was never returned. And you took a loss. Anyone have those financial realities? Yeah, of course you do. This is life. Maybe not on Job's scale, where he loses everything. But there are things that hurt. I don't even like parking tickets. That's a lot of money. Right? Well, it's all relative. Well, what happens? That's my own fault, oftentimes, but someone who is conniving, or lying, or cheating, or stealing. As you know, our house was burglarized last year, and I was very upset. How do you react, or how did you react, or how are you reacting now if this is your current circumstance? How does it make you feel? How does it make you feel towards God? Well, that's just round one. Because in verse 18 it says, while he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them and they are dead. And I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. Can you get the next picture, please? One of the most sad things that happened for me this past week was hearing that a friend of mine had their first child, but the child didn't make it. Actually, a friend of Norman's and mine, actually. A good friend of mine. I've known him since he was in high school. His first child passed away. They were born, but they didn't survive. I have been to funerals in which, and these are the worst funerals because they're funerals for infants. No parent should have to deal with that. But they do. There's something terrible about sitting in a funeral and seeing a box that small. A coffin. Job had 10 children. I don't know how big their families were. I don't know what grandchildren they had. But he lost his entire legacy in the next generation. It's completely wiped out. The level of Job's suffering or trials is immense. The loss of absolutely every asset. And then, compounded on top of this in the second round, or the tail end of this, he loses the people he loves. Remember, Job is the one who every morning after they gather, he prays for each of them by name. And he connects them to God because he purifies them. He asks them, he talks to them about this God. And where does this wind come from? This natural disaster that wipes them out. For the person who is listening, for all of us, we think about those who we may have lost in tragedy. It might not, again, be a degree. And there's a reason why their degrees are so high when it comes to Job. Because the story is trying to encompass everyone's. It cranks it all the way to 11. Past the 10. To say, this is his suffering. I don't know who you've lost. Whether it's in a broken relationship, a family member. Whether it's to dispute, or perhaps even to death itself. but how do you feel? More importantly, or maybe just as importantly, I don't think it's a more. How do you feel about God? How do you react to Him? How can you pray? How can you pray? How does one pray when you've either lost your fortune or your family? What does one say? The text tells us this in terms of Job's context. At this, all four disasters, Job got up, tore his robe, and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. I mean, the agony he was in, he just tore his clothes apart. He shaves his head as a sign of, I mean, what else do you do? These are just physical outworkings of his agony. And this was agony. We are meant to feel this. But then, his prayer. It says he falls down in worship of God, and he says this prayer. "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I will leave. I'm nothing. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. May the name of the Lord be praised." What? So at this point, in a lot of interpretations, people say this is the model by which you should face your suffering. This is how you should feel. Yes, you're sad, but you should worship God. Is this really what the book of Job is about? We're only in chapter 1. If this is what your takeaway is, I don't think you've read the whole thing. It gets worse. Believe you me. Back to the Super Bowl. Another day, the angels came, this is chapter 2 now, to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan comes, also came with them, and presented himself before God. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright. He's a man who fears God and shuns evil. And he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." Without any reason. "Skin for skin," Satan replied. "A man will give all he has for his own life. But now, stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well. Then he is in your hands. But you must spare his life." Whoa! What? What? You mean that wasn't bad enough, what already happened to Job? Can you get the next slide? So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. Wow, that's going to suck a lot. Satan's argument is this. "Oh, yeah, you took everything, but you know, he'll curse you if you really hurt him." "I hurt him what? Have you not hurt him enough?" says, no, now afflict his body. I don't know how many people here are sick with something, have some kind of chronic issue. As you know, sometimes I come in here and I get eczema. Right? My skin's all like wacky. Not pleasant, not the greatest thing. But some other people may have other things. Is it a joint pain? Is it, God forbid, a tumor? Is it that you used to be able to do certain things and you can't do it anymore, a slipped disc? Is it something that threatens your life? Is it an ongoing disease like diabetes? Is it something that just keeps on hurting you, in which your life is not good? It's not a level where you can just be carefree. You wake up in the morning, you do your things, you go home, you go to bed, and everything's great. Is it insomnia? It could be anything. A list of things that continue to plague you day after day after day. In Job's case, there's a reason why they put it is 100%. Again, they crank this thing past 10 to 11. From the soles of his feet to the crown of his head, he has boils. He's in constant pain. And, you know, the weird graphic detail is he takes a broken piece of pottery to scratch himself. I was like, dude, that's nasty. That's not nice. That's not good. So you imagine this is another imagining of Job, from that rich man with his sons, well-dressed, with the jet plane, everything else, the servants, to a man who's got nothing. He's on an ash heap. That's where they burn garbage, basically. And also, it's an aspect of grief. And he's just sitting there scratching himself with a broken piece of pottery. And now he's in constant pain. This is the story. This is the whole setting of the whole book of Job. Nobody gets a pass. Not Satan. And I know what the real question is, because this is where the book really is going. Not God. God does not get a pass. No matter what Job says. How do we react to suffering? Now, it's one thing to see a lot of suffering on TV because they like showing us suffering on TV. At least in Canada, they have some like great, you know, personal interest type stories that at least are a little cheerful. Because there's a lot of good things that happen in life, okay? There really are. A lot of fantastic things. But you know what's going on in your own life. You know what sucks in your own life. You know what hurts in your own life, and perhaps in the lives of those who are close to you. There are certain responses then regarding this text, regarding the story itself, that are within the story. So let me get the next slide. There's three responses, but I'll give you the two main ones. Number one, God does not get a pass, as I said, because he doesn't. But the reaction is, I hate God. His fault. He let this happen. I mean, I don't know what kind of biblical gymnastics you have to do to get past the reality that God is involved. That God at least knows and allows the suffering of Job. He allows it to happen. And so, one of the natural human reactions is to curse God to his face. That's what Satan wants, right? And that's how we know there's something going on here. Satan wants this. Satan knows this. That when we face suffering, He says, Job at some point is just going to curse you to your face. To give God the what for his suffering. And so we have throughout church history, as well as human history, the rejection of God, secularism, atheism, of all different sorts, to the point where now we have a whole group of what we call agnostic folk who just don't really care whether there is or isn't a God. And the excuse is normally like, I don't know. It's more like, well, frankly, from what I've been told about God and the fact he doesn't really care, I don't care either. And there's a whole spectrum within the rejection of God. So that's one reaction. The other one is, well, actually, if we go back a little bit, know that, we go back to the rejection of God, Job already embodies some of this. This already suggested in that story. In verse 9 of chapter 2, his wife says to him, she's the only one alive, but she's not giving him a good time. Are you still maintaining your integrity? Curse God and die. Wow, okay, that's kind of terse. I think she's not happy either. She embodies the voice of perhaps how a person reading or seeing this story might feel. What? God sucks. Curse him. And die. Sure, yeah, he's going to hit you with a lightning bolt, but what? You know, come on, your life is worse than terrible at this point. Just curse him. Do it. Do it. And so this is a rejection of God. But then he goes and says this, you're talking like a foolish woman. Shall I accept good from God and not trouble? In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. So this gets us to the next picture. Blind obedience and faith. And this is where the text leaves us. End of story. You now know everything about Job. Just do what he does, okay? Just say, God, it rocks. Even though you got boils on your head and you're sitting on the trash pile scratching yourself with a pot shirt, as they call it in the Bible. How does that feel to you? End the story. Just go worship God, everyone. He's great. He lets crappy things happen to you. Good story. And that's it. Go home. How does it feel? I think now is a good time for discussion. This is the story of Job. This is where the story begins. It does not give God a pass. It does not... Well, actually, if you just stop here, if you just read it really simply, yeah, when you suffer, love God. But as you read this, how do you feel about God? How do you think, maybe that's too personal. How do you think people feel about God? Let's not make it yourself. How do you think a normal person would feel about God? I'm not saying they are not normal, but... What do you think some reactions are? And this is not rhetorical questions now. What do you think? We're going to move this into the discussion phase. How do you feel about God? If this is all you had. Remember, there's over 30 chapters after this. I think you'd be with... I think most people would be with Job's wife. I mean, I when I'm reading this text, I'm going, God, you're not very good, are you? In fact, you're terrible. You are sick. I'm with Michael Hitchens. I'm with Dawkins on this now. God is a terrible God. It's full of hate. This is perverse. Why would he let any of this stuff happen? Why did he even listen to Satan? What's going on? If you're not upset by the end of chapter 2, there's something wrong with you spiritually. Okay? Really. As a story reader, as a storyteller, if you don't see people going, this is terrible, you're not reading Job. The thankful part about it is not done. You can look at the book a little bit. There's more. Because if it ends here, everyone should not only be an atheist, but someone who hates God. So why are you here? And why am I preaching that? Take you to the next slide. I told you that there's two responses. Reject God or blind faith. But there is another response. And that is where the rest of the book of Job is going to travel. It's going to a deeper place. And that's why this sermon today is actually the setup, but it needs to be heard. Have you ever been upset with God? Have you ever been upset with your parents? Don't let you eat the cookies? Whatever. I mean, that's a simplistic thing, but something that you're upset about because you're not getting what you want. Or actually, there's an aspect of suffering. And we're not just talking about something being withheld. We're talking about real loss, real suffering, real pain. How do you feel about God? This is where all the scriptures point. This is the question we are asked. How do you feel about Him? You talk about personal relationship with God? Great. Fantastic. How do you feel about Him? Because if you don't go there, I don't know what your prayers are made of. The reality is you read this and you say, Job is nuts. There's something wrong with that guy. How can he be like, you know, you foolish woman. How can we accept, you know, good from God and not evil? It's like, are you for real? I've never seen anyone talk like that. Like, is he brainwashed? What's going on with that guy? Is he, like, disabled? So this is where we go. But I'm going to give you a real hint about where the book is really going to end up. When we think about suffering, we like to avoid it in our culture. We think it's actually the greatest evil. But I want to remind you what we do every Sunday. Can you get us to the next slide? This is blood. That's what it represents. This is flesh. This is a real small and nice version of a method of execution. What do you think you're doing here? You think we're playing games and we think we're feeling good about ourselves? We've got an execution device. I mean, I must have put an electric chair or maybe some needles and, you know, some poison. This is actually what is that in the front of most churches today. This is something every single Christian practices. The drinking of the blood. The eating of the flesh. Suffering is at the very center of where we meet with God. But in this case, we're looking not at our own suffering in itself. Job suffers. But we also recognize that God suffers. I mean, God's story, I mean, Job's story is really wacky. I mean, they crank the whole thing to 11, right? As we say. That's not normal suffering. We all suffer, but usually it's not that bad, is it? Maybe we should ask some of our Syrian friends. Some who have actually lost their entire families. Whose entire fortunes are completely destroyed. Jesus meets with us and asks us to remember His suffering. That God is present in our suffering is actually one of the keys to understanding Job. But not yet. This is for us now. So when you go from this place, you recognize both Job's suffering, your suffering, our world's suffering, and begin to ask about, why do we do this? What is this suffering? Let's pray. God, how can we say to you, we'll take the good and the bad from you? It's hard for us sometimes to think poorly of you, because we've been inured to think only good things about you. But perhaps in the back of our minds, in the crevices, we doubt. And this book, your word, scares out from those closets a real doubt, real questions. And we visit that once again, not just merely for our sakes. Perhaps our faith is unshakable, Lord, and you would know that. Or is it? We also look upon the world and our friends who don't feel the same way as we might about you. They only hear stories like Job's. And now we begin to perhaps understand why someone might hate you, might reject you. Perhaps we've been there ourselves. And so, Lord, have mercy on us. As we come to this table, help us to find solidarity with you, realizing that it is you who come to express solidarity with us. Help us to fathom these mysteries. Help us not to be comfortable. Help us to know you. Amen.